welcome everyone to the class on pitfalls. Growing up, I went to church in Whiteville, Tennessee. How many of y'all been to Whiteville, Tennessee? Church there. Okay, a couple. And they've remodeled it since then, but I remember walking in the entrance, there was stairs going up into the auditorium, and then there were stairs going down into the basement part where we had our carry-in lunches and things like that. And when you walked down the stairs, there was a low beam or that went across that was lower than it should have been. And you learned that when you went down the stairs, you just kind of ducked your head sideways. And even us younger boys, we weren't tall enough to hit it anyway, but we would duck sideways to make sure we, you know, that's what everyone else did. And you learned not to hit that. But we had visitors every now and then. And more than one man had an unpleasant meeting with that beam crossing the stairs. But maybe we should have had a sign there saying, watch out, watch your head. And sometimes you see signs like that. Those are very, very helpful. Now, I wasn't sure, am I supposed to be excited about talking about pitfalls, or should I be sad and discouraged talking about pitfalls? But I hope I can be excited about them, because I'd like to tell you about that beam so you don't whack yourself on the side of the head as you're rushing down the stairs. It's being aware of pitfalls is the first step in staying out of them. We don't need to repeat all the mistakes of others. You know, there's a saying, the only thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history, but that doesn't have to be true. I hope you can listen to some of the mistakes that I've made and stay out of them yourself. So the main points I'd like to go over, the main pitfalls that I've found in my years of teaching, that aren't very many, is number one is faulty self-concept. We just have a bad view about ourselves. The second thing is ignorance of technique. And we learned about some technique this morning, how to have a proper class. The third thing is poor planning, which we talked about in the last class. Poor planning. And the last one is ineffective discipline. I've already heard teachers say teaching school would just be a lot of fun if you wouldn't have to worry about discipline. But unfortunately, it's just not the case. You will have to do discipline. And how can that be effective? If it's not effective, then it's a pitfall that you can go into. All right, so let's look at some things about a faulty self-concept. Some of my favorite verses in the Bible are found in Philippians. It says, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became a teacher." That's not how it goes, but that's how it is sometimes. Being a teacher is, you have to be willing to humble yourself. A lot of problems in teaching come from just being proud. How many of you are proud? Okay, well, I was expecting that many hands. Thanks for being honest. You know, it's not something I don't think we would say, hopefully you're not just proud, but maybe it's something you deal with. It's something you have to daily deal with, pride in your hearts and being, and constantly crucifying that sinful nature, that old man that wants to rise up. Okay, and this thing of thinking about ourselves and faulty self-concept, I think one of the big things that new teachers, a pitfall that you fall into, is wanting too much to be liked. Okay, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be liked. We want our students to like us, but yet we don't do it at the expense. It's not at the expense of doing the right thing. Sometimes we have to choose between doing the right thing and the student liking us. See, friends, you know, can you really be their friend as a teacher? Can you be the student's friend? Wong, in his book, The First Days of School, says, be friendly, caring, loving, and sensitive, but do not be their friend. They have enough on their hands with their own friends. And let me explain. See, friends do favors for friends. Can we have extra recess? Can we play outside? Can we play for story? Can we skip math class today? We finished all our work. Can we go outside and play? If you're their friend, then of course the answer is yes. Yes, sure. Then one day they ask a favor and you say no. Then they get upset. I thought you were my friend. Friends don't give grades to each other. They don't admonish each other. They don't tell their friends what to do. Friends don't make other friends work hard and then grade their effort. Friends don't discipline friends. That's the teacher's job. Be the teacher. Be an example for them. Don't join in the argument about which kind of truck is the best. Because, well, then there's no one to end the argument. Just don't get involved with that thing, even though it might be tempting at times. You know, we fool ourselves into thinking that if we let the students do what they want, not necessarily just do whatever they want, but just, you know, let them do what they want, you know, then they will like us. And that's not true. Think back to your teenage years. You know, did you always like your parents? But did they ever tell you no? You know, sometimes you probably didn't like them, but, you know, looking back now, hopefully you see that, you know, there was a reason they said no, and you're glad they did tell you no sometimes. The second thing is getting discouraged. That's the second pitfall I have. Proverbs 13, verse 12 says, "Hope deferred maketh the heart sick, but when the desire cometh, it is the tree of life." And I think one big reason teachers get discouraged is because their expectations were too high. And we talked about in the preparation class about making sure you have high expectations for your students, and that is important, but don't think everything is going to be perfect. Like romance novels where everything always works out perfectly and the handsome young man and the stunningly beautiful girl get married and live happily ever after. It's dangerous to think like that and to go into your teaching thinking that everything is just going to work out perfectly. That's not real life. Don't have your expectations too high in that regard. You know, your students are always, they're going to be successful. They're going to all get good grades and be able to learn easily. Don't try to be somebody else. That can make you discouraged. Or copy another teacher. You know, we can't all teach like Ivan Martin or Joe Novena or Jaden. We can't teach like them. He didn't teach like that. Neither one of them taught like they do now the first year they taught school. I'm convinced of that. You're not going to be able to teach that great the first year of school. Sorry. Do the best you can, absolutely. But don't be discouraged if it doesn't measure up to some of these teachers you see here at WFTI. They weren't like that the first year they taught. One experienced teacher gave me some advice the first year I taught. You know, this is a question you'll get asked a lot, is how are things going for you? And he told me, some people ask you that, just don't even answer them. Just tell them it's too soon to tell. Because what do you say if things aren't going well? Don't judge yourself by the first few weeks. Wait until you've taught at least 6 months to decide how it's going. Because it might take a while. The third thing is letting little things affect your emotions. And this is probably more of a lady problem than it is for guys. Because women are much more intuitive about seeing things. I know when I was teaching, my co-teacher would catch on to things out on the playground, you know, maybe attitudes or different things I never even noticed. But just make sure we don't let little things affect us. My wife was teaching school once, and after recess, one of her students came in to the classroom, and she noticed his pockets were quite bulging, and she asked him, what's in his pockets? And he said, acorns. He had his pockets filled with acorns. Don't need those in the classroom. I guess she could have used them to teach him how to multiply and divide and add and subtract. But she said, no, please go outside and get the acorns out of your pockets. So he goes outside. Doesn't come back in. So where is he at? So she goes out and check on him. So she walked to the door and she looked out the window, and he's out there on his laying down, and he's kind of going back and forth on the ground, and she's like, what are you doing? And he's like, these acorns, they just won't come out. You know, she could have looked at that and thought, he's just being rebellious. He's being disobedient. You know, I need to really crack down on him. And she could have really taken that as a that he's just not listening to her. But I don't think it was that attitude at all. You know, he was just trying to be funny. That was his thing. And I'm not saying you should always let it go that, or let it go or not deal with it. But don't always take something like that just like they're really just being rebellious. Don't let it affect your emotions too much. Another thing that students will do is they will, maybe you have to get a substitute teacher, and then you come back and you're asked how it went, just kind of like hoping that we just really missed you and we couldn't wait for you to come back to the classroom again. But no, they just, we love the substitute teacher, that was great. And we take it as a personal insult that, they don't like us. But that's not the case. They will always like the substitute teacher better than you because they give them extra recess and they give them candy and things like that, and you can't do that every day. So it doesn't mean they don't like you. The fourth thing is feeling too responsible for the students. And again, there's two ditches here, so please understand me. I'm not saying you shouldn't feel like you're responsible to cause them to learn, because you are responsible. But don't feel too responsible for them. It's not your job to carry the student on your back. You know, it's our job to show them the way and to help them. But we can't carry them on our backs. And it is very depressing to a teacher to see failing grades, checking over papers. I just think, for me, there's nothing more depressing than checking over papers and seeing a 60% or even a 30%. It's depressing. And yes, we must do something about it. We can't let those grades make us feel like a failure to the extent that we just want to give up. Teaching is a lot more than grades. Someone much wiser than me said, games are not won by watching the scoreboard. You don't win games by watching the scoreboards. You don't become a good teacher by watching the grades of the students. That's not a good measure of your success or failure. Another teacher that I asked, I said, What is the pitfall that you've experienced? And he said, focusing too much on the academics. That can be a pitfall. Focusing too much on the grades. That's not what it's all about. It's easy for us to judge ourselves by the grades that our students get, but that's not what it's all about. There's a lot more goes on in teaching than good grades. We do our sustainable best. Even Jesus had a student who failed his class. The fifth thing is being too perfectionistic. How many of you filled in every blank on the handout in my last class, the preparation? Did any of y'all fill every blank in? Maybe? Well, good job. That's wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. You might be one of the ones that struggle with being perfectionistic. I know I was. And it's good to be thorough and complete. I love that. But sometimes in teaching, you have to let some things go. How much time do we spend checking over their work? How much time do we agonize whether to count a problem wrong or half wrong or a quarter wrong or maybe just count it right? Is one percentage point going to really make that much difference in their overall grade? And then we end up not having enough time to do the important things like studying for the next lesson. I'm not saying we should be careless. It's just the problem with wanting to be perfect is that we often become discouraged then when things aren't perfect. Do your sustainable best. Again, like what I said earlier, sometimes we can really get a lot done. Sometimes we can put in 12-hour days at school making sure that all the checking gets done perfectly and that everything is ready for tomorrow and we've studied and studied and studied and there's just so much we can do. But we can't. That's not sustainable. Perhaps spending 12 hours a day, especially if you have other responsibilities, you'll get burned out very fast if you're spending that much time at school. And especially for you first year teachers, it's probably overwhelming to you. I hope it's overwhelming to you to think of preparing and teaching all the subjects in four or five different grades. But you won't be able to teach every subject perfectly that first year. It's much better to focus on one subject and just put a little extra effort in that subject and teach that lesson, that subject extra well, and then maybe not put as much effort into the others. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Next year, you can put the effort into another subject. That's why there's a benefit of teaching more than 1 year, so that you can get good in all of them. You know, you have to teach at least 8 years, right, to get good in all of 8 subjects or however many subjects you have. I don't know. Another thing is resisting advice or not asking for advice or for help. And I'd like to read a story out of this book, Seven Laws of the Learner. Listen carefully, and I want you to tell me the 3 main characters and 1 word that describes each one, each character. These particular trout are very difficult to catch, he said. They suck in your fly, sense the hook, and immediately spit it out. You have to set the hook in that split second or he's gone. Do you think you can do that? Of course, I replied. After all, hadn't I caught all kinds of fish in lakes, ponds, and the ocean? Trout fishing in the Colorado Mountains would be a snap. The guide continued his instructions. If you cast over there and let your fly float downstream for about 20 or 30 feet, you'll probably get a few bites. I did as he said, but nothing happened. Within seconds, he said, you missed one. And a moment later, there, you missed another one. What on earth are you talking about? I hadn't felt or seen anything. You don't believe a couple of trout actually bit your hook, do you? I guess he couldn't miss my look of skepticism. Let me have your pole and I'll show you what I mean. On the next cast, he caught a big old trout right where my fly had been. I couldn't believe my eyes. Over and over again, our trusty guide worked with us. He would encourage us by saying, it's in the feel of the pole and the fly is moving in the water. You've got to learn to tempt the trout. Nonetheless, hours went by without my catching a fish, and I was beginning to lose hope. Then all of a sudden, I began to catch those trout right where we had fished earlier. I can now feel the river. Everything he said began to click. What a thrill! Later that afternoon, a young teenager carrying a large red and yellow tackle box climbed down the bank where we were fishing. We smiled encouragingly. But then he took out some large lures used to catch bass and even saltwater fish, but certainly not trout. Our guide worked his way up to the young kid and began to instruct him that those lures didn't appeal to trout, but a certain kind of fly did. The young man told the guide to get lost. He'd fish with his own favorite lures and he'd catch fish just like he did back home. Soon our guide led us around the bend to a different patch of water that moved much more swiftly. He began to search through his fishing vest for a particular fly. He smiled when he found a couple of them. These flies are the only ones I know that will catch the trout in this section of the river. I made them last night just for this spot. They're heavy enough to sink into that strong current, and they'll tempt those trout every time. He was right. We changed flies and immediately started catching larger trout. After a while, we returned to where that young man was fishing. He hadn't caught any fish yet and was obviously frustrated. Stupid fish, he exclaimed. They just aren't biting. I hate fishing. Our guide was a master fisherman. As the afternoon passed and we paid close attention to his instruction and his example, we slowly became more and more effective trout fishermen. Just as he'd said, it was all in the right lure on the end of your string and the right action on the pole. The fish are always there and can be caught if you know how. Stop there. What are the 3 main characters? One of them.
The guide.
The guide.
The fisherman.
The fisherman, author.
Yeah. The lad.
Okay, the young lad. One word to describe each of them. The guide.
Experienced.
The author.
Learner.
Good. Teachable. And the young
man?
Foolish.
Foolish. Very good. Thank you. A wise man will hear and will increase learning, and a man of understanding shall attain unto wise counsel. It's so important. There's a situation of which I was aware where there was a teacher that was having problems, and his teacher was called in, I believe it was his teacher, was called in to give him some help, give him some advice. I think his school board had already tried to work with him, and they couldn't really, and so they asked his teacher to come back and try to help him out. And so his teacher went to him, maybe asked him, and he explained, well, the teacher said, well, you know, when I was in school, I had a different teacher for every year that I taught. And I took the strengths and bests of each teacher, and that's how I'm teaching. What can you do? You can't help somebody like that. Don't be that person. Be willing to take advice from others. Okay, moving on to the second main area of pitfalls. Ignorance of technique. Bruce, would you care to take a bite into this banana?
No.
Why not?
Still got the peel.
Okay, it has a peel. You know, there was a man that was given a banana for the first time, and they laughed him later, well, how was it? And he said, it wasn't bad, pretty stringy, had a lot of core. You know, it does matter how we do things, right? Knowing how to do it the right way, it can make a big difference in how your teaching will go. And we learned about that this morning again. That's wonderful. Okay, so expecting books and gadgets to do the teaching for you. It may be easy for you as a teacher to think that, oh, if I just had a different curriculum, then I could be a good teacher. Or if I had a computer program that would just keep track of all my grades and that would really make it I could teach well. Don't blame the books on a lack of learning. It doesn't matter if you use Rod and Staff or Christian Light. Just don't expect them to do the work for you. We have to be willing to put effort into it ourselves and do our part. You know, how much time do we waste on our computers doing grades and things like that? It can be a waste of time. Games are not won by watching the scoreboard. The second thing is not knowing the sequence of class presentation. Make sure you know what is the proper order to do things. We learned about that this morning in a review and checking their work, and then the new lesson, and maybe some more review. And even like, are you going to have the students read the lesson before they come to class? That can be a big help, so they already know what you're going to be talking about, and they have maybe somewhat of a grasp on what's going on. Have them read the lesson first. Third thing is giving too much or too little work. This is a tough one to call. I don't know if you remember being in school, you know, did you feel overworked or did you feel like you had just lots of time? But often in the beginning of the year, the students are working at maximum capacity and they have lots of enthusiasm and, you know, everything is going well. And then, you know, in the spring, then things are kind of winding down and they just feel so overwhelmed. So it's really hard to tell sometimes, but I like to compare it to this. We have an ice cream maker and we like to make homemade ice cream. So you put all the ingredients in and you start it up and it just spins smoothly. How do you know when the ice cream is done? But there's a sound you listen for. When the ice cream is almost done, it's like, and you hear that groan and you know the ice cream is ready then. So sometimes when you're teaching, different students will be different. Some can take more than others, but listen for that sound. They're working in maximum capacity because, you know, if you let it go too long, the motor is going to burn out on the ice cream maker. But if you don't do it long enough, then the ice cream will be running; it won't be good either. So listen for that sound when you're teaching, that you know they're working at maximum capacity. Another thing is assigning without motivating, assigning work without motivating them to want to. And this is a question that probably all of you will hear, probably this year, maybe. Why do I have to learn this stuff? When am I ever going to use this? And that can really intimidate a new teacher. You might feel threatened by that, you know. And sometimes it's better not to answer that one right away. Because they might not even want to know. They just want to challenge you, perhaps. But it is good, as much as possible. Give them real-life examples of ways they're going to use this material. In your class, you know, how much paint would it take, you know, to paint that wall? And we're not going to paint the window. How much paint? How do we figure that out on your teaching area? If they enjoy horses, use horses in your problems. If you have five horses and each horse requires 2 acres of pasture, how many acres of pasture do they require? And how much fence would it take to encircle those 10 acres? Another thing is thinking for the students. I've got another story from my school days. So in school we were eating lunch, and I had an orange in my lunch, and I didn't like to peel oranges. I'm not sure why. So I asked my teacher if he could peel the orange for me. He had done it before, so I handed it to him to peel the orange for me. Anyway, and so we kept eating lunch and visiting and talking, and lunchtime was over, and I looked over, and there were the peels, but the orange was gone. And I was like, where's my orange? Oh, I ate it. He totally forgot about what he was doing, and he ended up eating the orange. Well, didn't do me a lot of good. But you know, sometimes we do that as teachers. The student maybe asks us a question about, you know, how do we figure this out? And we peel the orange and then we just eat it as well, and they don't get the enjoyment of figuring it out themselves. You know, let them taste the success of figuring that thing out. The one who is working is the one who is learning. Don't ever tell them the answer, especially in story problems. Don't tell them the answer. Please don't. If they need help, you know, ask questions. What is the important information in this story problem? Should you choose subtraction or addition or multiplication or division to solve it? Ask them questions to help lead them, but let them figure it out so they can taste that success of finding the right answer. Let them do the science experiments. That's very important. I know they might make mistakes. That's fine. Let them make the mistakes. And then ask them, well, what went wrong? And have them figure out what went wrong. And that might not be appropriate every time. But that's a good way to help them learn. Ask lots of questions. Again, the one who is working is the one who is learning. If you're doing all the work, then you're the only one that's learning. Okay, the third main area of pitfalls is poor planning. And I know we talked about this before, but we'll just talk about some of this stuff again. Poor planning. First thing is neglecting important things to do urgent things. Neglecting important things to do urgent things. It's sometimes hard to know what to do. What we have these many big lists of things that need to be done. We have to decide what is important and what is urgent. Let me give you an example. So let's say you're on the way to the airport, and halfway there you look at your gauge and you see you're almost out of fuel. You don't have enough to get to the airport. Now, it's extremely urgent that we get to the airport on time or we're going to miss our flight. That's very urgent. But which is more important to do? Keep going and make it to the airport or stop to fill up with gas? And sometimes in teaching, we get some of these things. Like, for example, school duties can seem very urgent, checking those tests or whatever, because they have to be done before tomorrow. It can seem very urgent, but there might be something that's more important to do, like having your morning devotions in the morning. It's easy to skip that because we have a bunch of stuff that we have to do. But you can't run on empty. Or what about, you know, you're trying to finish report cards, and then your co-teacher comes in with a problem. Which is urgent? Which is most important? Or going to prayer meeting in the evening. The second thing is failing to allow for the unexpected. Failing to allow for the unexpected. It's just crazy some of the things that can happen sometimes. One time I was on my way to school with a gallon of iced coffee for us, for the teachers and myself, and I was going around a sharp curve, and this is in Tennessee, and the iced coffee, whoop, flipped over on the side, and there goes my iced coffee. No! It's like, I'm driving, reach down and quickly flip it up and kind of back on the, you know, to my steering wheel again, but somehow during that time I got off the road just a little bit, and so I swerved to get back on again, and overcorrected, and next thing you know, I'm sliding across the road thankful I wasn't going very fast, but I still was sliding out of control. And just then I see another truck coming around the curve. And thankfully, he wasn't going fast either. And he was able to slow down just enough to where that he only damaged my truck and didn't damage me or him, but it was a bad mess. And I got to school quite late that morning. You know, sometimes we don't allow for things like that. But another example is one time we decided to do an extra project for school. We've been reading the Chronicles of Narnia, and if you don't read those books, there's one story about the Turkish delight that the Wicked Witch was giving to the one the boy. And so, hey, that'd be fun to make Turkish delight. Let's do that. And so I told the students what to bring. We all brought stuff the next day, and we're going to set aside an hour class period. We're going to make Turkish delight. And so we did. We tried. But it took a lot longer than an hour to make Turkish delight. You're supposed to boil the sugar and we tried to rush the project, and it just did not work. When we were done, it was some nasty looking stuff because I didn't take time to try to make it ahead of time. The third thing is not planning in enough detail. Some of these things overlap, but the idea I'm trying to get here is do some of the problems yourself. When you're studying for the lesson, you might glance over and think, oh yeah, I know how to do this. But then when class time comes and you're trying to show the student, oh, something comes up and, oh, how do I do this? So do some of the problems yourself to make sure that you do know how to do it. Because otherwise you'll embarrass yourself in front of your students like I have done. The fourth thing is worrying about having enough to say. And I don't know what type of person you're like, but I dare say most of you probably won't have that problem. Most of the time I talk too much. And it's better to let the students not talk too much and not get the students bored. You know, if we keep on talking after the students have stopped listening, then that's just like keeping on teaching after the students have left for home. It's pointless. You're just wasting their time. Don't keep on talking after they've stopped listening. The fourth main area of pitfalls is ineffective discipline. And the first thing in that is being afraid to discipline for fear the students will not like you. Again, that is a false concept. Students, they want you to take charge. They expect that you're going to deal with misbehavior. And if you don't do it, you will lose their respect. You will lose their respect. Second part of that is adding rules or procedures after problems arise. You heard it, you know, the first day of school, you want to have your procedures in place. It can save you so much work and so much pain. You know, sometimes they have these, a lot of people raise these dogs that are so cute and they sell for $2,000. And of course, to make them really cute, you have to cut off the whole tail, right? And they have these little no-tail dogs. They've been detailed. Imagine how it would be for these poor dogs if you would cut off an inch and then wait a couple months and then cut it off another inch and then wait a couple months and then cut off another inch. The poor dog. But sometimes we do that in school teaching. We don't want to cut off his whole tail. That's mean. Let's just cut off a little bit. And then later on, well, we have to cut off a little more. And it makes it, just cut the whole thing off and then you're done. And sometimes there will be cases where you have to maybe implement a procedure in the middle of the year. That's not wrong. It's better to do it then than not at all, perhaps. But it's better if you can do it at the beginning of the year. Third thing is over-lecturing instead of disciplining. You know, this is a common situation that you'll probably face. You're at recess time and you're playing ball and one team has 15 points and the other team has one. And Johnny is pretty upset about this. And he's just not having fun at all. You can see he's very upset. Maybe he chews out one of the younger ones on his team for making a bad play. And so you call him to the side or you send him inside. Hey, Johnny, go in, put your head down on your desk, and then you keep on playing. And after everyone goes in, you call him out and you talk to him and you say, now, Johnny, you know it's wrong to get mad when your team is losing. And of course, he's had some time to think about this. And so you're not going to do that again, right? Great. Problem solved, right? Well, that might be good for the first time, but don't just do that every time. We keep on doing that. We're not going to get anywhere. Sometimes we just have to discipline. Postponing the discipline only causes the students to lose respect for you. Brian Tracy said, I don't remember which book it is. Do you know? He says, when you must eat a frog, get it done. This stuff like frogs, it doesn't get any prettier or more pleasant by ignoring or anticipating it. And he even says, if there's two frogs, eat the uglier one first. Just get it done. I know it's not fun to give that spanking. I dreaded that. But if you have to do it, get it done. It doesn't get easier. The situation, maybe it just be a situation where the students are being disrespectful. Deal with it right away. It will not get better by ignoring it. The fourth thing is trusting the students too much. And I know they look like little angels sometimes. I had some students that looked they look like they just are just well-behaved students. But they're not. They are fully capable of doing things that you wouldn't imagine. I know one story of where a teacher, I guess, decided to open his eyes during prayer. Pray with his eyes open. The Bible says watch and pray. And he prayed with his eyes open, and he saw a student standing on his head during prayer. I don't know how he managed to get to that position without the teacher finding out before. But yeah, so you know, sometimes you have to watch and pray, and maybe you'll learn something. Don't trust them too much. Yes, we need to trust them to some extent. We can't just always be peeking around the door to watch them. But in a sense, we do need to know what's going on. I think another teacher. I think this was Jonathan Erb that did this. Before he went out, he had to go out to do something. Before he went out, he asked his students, "Are you think y'all can be quiet and keep to your work while I'm out?" And of course, you know, most of them would raise their hand, maybe, and then those that wouldn't, he said, "Okay, well, why don't you come with me?" And those that wouldn't would go out with him, you know, to whatever he was doing, and I think probably gave him a talking to or something. But you know, that can be helpful to do something like that. The next thing is not communicating with the parents or the school board. Ivan Martin's talks. I hope you can catch everything he says. I know it's a lot, but a lot of that stuff just really resonates. A lot of it, really good stuff. Be quick to talk to the parents. Include positive and negative feedback. Don't just call the parents up every time something bad happens. You need to call and give some encouragement. Maybe even, especially the ones that are bad or that do cause more problems. If they do something well, you know, maybe even just call, like during supper time is a good time to call, and the dad answers the phone and you say, "Hello, this is Mr. Derek. Could I speak with Johnny?" And the dad's like, "Oh no, what happened now?" You know, and then he gives the phone to Johnny and say, "Johnny, I just got finished checking your spelling test and you got a 90%. Way to go. Thank you. Have a good evening." And Johnny's like, you know, wow, you know, and everyone else hears this has happened. It just you just made him look good in front of his family, and that can be just a tremendous encouragement to him, and to the parents as well. They don't want to be always if they groan inwardly when they see you're calling them, then something's wrong. One goal you could have is just simply to call one of the parents or like one set of parents or one of the parents every week of your school teaching. I don't know how many parents you'd be working with, but that's a good start. Contact them and just tell them how their child is doing. It's not just negative. Be quick to talk with parents, especially when you're dealing with misbehavior problems. They are on your side. They really are. And if you talk with them, it can really make a difference in the child's behavior. Don't wait until it just gets so bad and then go pour everything out onto them. And be specific when you're talking with them. Don't just say, your child is just really being a pain. you know, say,
Johnny out on the softball field today, he really got upset when his team was losing, and he really chewed out one of the younger players for a mistake.
And be specific about what happened so they can know what to do. If you just, Johnny is just, he's just such a horrible student, doesn't play right. We need to be specific so they know what's going on. All right. Lots of pitfalls. There's a lot more pitfalls out there, too. We're not going to go over all the pitfalls and areas that you can make mistakes in. These are some of the main ones. You know, you're going to make mistakes. Don't think that you're going to go into a classroom and you're never going to make mistakes. You probably will fall into some of these pits that we talked about. That's okay. Maybe being aware of them now will even help you when you fall into them, maybe help you get out sooner because you realize, yeah, this is a pitfall. I remember Derek talking about that. Don't get discouraged. The only dumb mistake is the one you keep on making. The only dumb mistake is the one you keep on making. Learn from your mistakes. Don't expect to keep trying the same solution to the problem and expect different results. Try something different. Listen to the advice from others. Stop, look, listen, and pray often. Don't become one of the 50% of teachers who quit because they feel discouraged, alone, overworked, and underpaid. Because constantly falling into pitfalls is depressing, discouraging, and quitting. And perhaps one day you will quit teaching, but hopefully it won't be because of pitfalls. It will be because God called you elsewhere. So again, the takeaway for this class is awareness of the common pitfalls is the first step to staying out of them. Thank you.